G'day everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome again to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. My guest on the pod this week is the head of Erebus Motorsport, Barry Ryan. Controversial, polarizing, plenty of descriptive words used about him over the journey from supercars fans. But you know what? He doesn't care about any of it. He's a racer's racer. He's a guy who loves to win, who loves to compete, and it's all about P1. And from the two-part pod that we've got, this is part one, part two to come next week. You'll gain a real insight into why he is how he is. We talk about a bunch of stuff. On part one on this pod, we talk about how he was only a few days old when he went to his first race. Racing is most definitely in Barry's blood. We talk about him going racing himself on two wheels and how he started in V8 supercars. In fact, how his very first Bathurst with John Faulkner Racing also clashed with his wedding. Who gets away with that? Wedding and Bathurst on the same weekend, let alone being in a wedding and working at Bathurst rather than just being a fan or going to a wedding. Amazing stuff. We talk about his time at Kmart Racing and that infamous 5-minute penalty for Greg Murphy at the Mountain in 2002. We talk about how Barry found a very happy home at Larry Perkins' team at Perkins Engineering for quite a bit of time. And we also talk on this part about how he came to end up at Erebus Motorsport. So here we go. Buckle up. It's a great chat. Time to start part one with Barry Ryan on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco.
Well, Barry Ryan, we are sitting in... Oh, I feel like I'm in trouble. We're sitting in your office at Erebus Motorsport, and I guess this is kind of the nerve center of this race team. Thanks for sitting down. There's model cars in front of us. There's parts of Erebus Commodores. There's trophies lurking around. This is a cool place to be. This is the best place I reckon I've ever done a podcast.
It's a good little office. I've set it up a couple of years ago to look a bit nicer and be a bit more professional. It used to be just a desk chucked in the corner. It's actually Ross Stone's old desk from Stone Brothers, so it's got a bit of history.
The actual desk?
Yeah.
So our listeners – I said readers then. That doesn't work, does it? Our listeners won't see this, but it's a lovely wooden desk. Oh, it's quite nice. So this was clearly too good to get rid of. This had to come south.
Yeah, Ross Stone. So, yeah, I'm sitting at the same desk he used to, essentially.
Yeah, literally.
So, supercar legend.
So this is, I guess, one way to tie together the obvious history, the Stone Brothers into Erebus. There's a connection to this day.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I thought it was a bit strange to start off with, and I thought, it's a nice desk. You can't get rid of that. So won some championships, so if anything rubs off, it's good.
Not a bad thing at all. I know that you've kept an eye leading up to this chat on our Facebook page, so you're aware of some of the questions that are going to follow a little bit later on. But tell me about how did you get in this mad caper of motor racing? Is this a family thing that dragged you into this? What got you in? So we're going right back to the very start here.
Oh, the very start. I think, you know, the week I was born, Dad took me to the Speedway because Dad grew up around Speedway and was always either racing or end up being a starter and, you know, did all the official stuff as well. And, I guess it's just in my blood. I got no choice. Dad took me to the races from the word go. And as soon as I was sort of old enough to race something, he was had me on either motorbikes or beach buggies or race go-karts and race motorbikes and did all the racing myself and always had Dad by my side. So,
whereabouts was this? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Frankston, actually.
Oh, Franger.
I was a Franger boy, yep. Dad raced at Niora and Avalon, which is obviously still current tracks. And, from what I'm told, within 3 days of being born, I was at the races on the Saturday night. So, I can't remember it.
Yeah, you haven't left.
Yeah.
So, did you have the aspiration of being a driver rider, or was it a case of working on cars, or just anything to do with an engine?
I think the dream was always you always want to drive or ride, or, you know, motorbikes was my first passion and probably still is now. Learn on motorbikes. Dad had, you know, beach buggies and stuff that was just you could go in the paddock and bash around and paddock bashes. And so I think I learned to drive a Volkswagen Beetle beach buggy thing when I was probably 8, as soon as I could reach the pedals and drive a manual. So, I guess it got to a point eventually in my, I'll call it, racing career that I just knew that I couldn't afford it. And, I went the motorbike route racing because it was cheaper than cars, and then just got to a point I was too smart or too scared to go fast. So,
or both.
Yeah, a bit of both.
But, yeah, and are we talking motocross or road racing or speedway? Or what?
It's funny, I've never actually raced on dirt, but I've got one in 4 weeks coming up that I'm taking on. But I actually road raced, so, yeah, I went – road racing seemed like the best route to actually get into racing at a cost-effective way, and it probably still is. You can buy a bike pretty cheap and buy some leathers and go racing, and that's what I did. And, yeah, I probably didn't have the bravery I needed to go to another level, where my younger brother did, and he went pretty far. But, yeah, then I got to a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. Decided I'd go do something where it was like mechanic. So I've always grown up with Dad, same thing. He's always worked on his own cars, panel beaded, spray painted, did everything in his own cars. He's an engineer in his own right. So Dad sort of taught me that. I was working in his workshop when I was 12, so I knew how to pull apart engines and panel beat cars and spray paint cars when I was really young. So that sort of naturally evolved into working on cars. So yeah, it's funny. I was a motor mechanic for did my apprenticeship for a lot of years and worked with Peter Macro.
He's
obviously a well-known racer in his own right. His sons, Tim and Adam. And yeah, I got to a point where I was sick of being a mechanic, just a car mechanic, and
is it a road car mechanic?
Yeah, road car
versus
mechanic.
A race car mechanic.
Yeah, well, I still got my fix going racing and doing my own thing and my brother racing and stuff.
And what sort of bikes were you riding, like road racing?
250 production bikes.
Yeah,
I raced 250 Grand Prix bikes. I raced 600 Super Sports. So.
Any names that our listeners might know of that were on the grids in those days?
Cameron Donald, obviously he was a champion. Yeah.
Isle of Man stuff.
John Sciotto ran Monza Imports. Adam Ferguson, guys like that. Yeah, this was back in the early 90s, so there's not many.
It's not that long ago, mate. You make it out like it's ancient history. Yeah, it's not even close.
But, yeah, it was good fun. It was good fun back then, but I just wasn't crazy enough for motorbikes. So, yeah, I gave that up before I spent too much money on someone. I wasn't going to – everything I do, I want to win. So when I realized I couldn't win, I just didn't want to waste the money on it anymore.
We've learned that about you over time. You do like to win. You do love a win.
I can't just do it to have fun. That's the problem. But
yeah,
nowadays, yeah, I can. I'll go and do this enduro in a few weeks and have some fun.
What's this enduro? What do you got
cooking? Oh, it's a Transmoto 8-hour enduro, and there's four of us doing it. It's a weekend warrior class. It's called. So you do basically 2 hours each, but it's pretty much sounds like about a 20-minute loop, 17K loop, and you can swap at the end of each loop. There's some guys in the Ironman class that do the full 8 hours. So we're starting low. We're doing four of us riding, and if someone breaks down, obviously someone will do a bit more. But it's the first time I've been able to be in the dirt and in the bush with everybody going the same way. So I know. The problem is at the end of the laps, I'll be looking at the times and trying to go faster. But I'm going to try and control myself.
You're going to have a crack. So, yeah, you go to control and keep that down. So how does the link come from doing the car, road car mechanic stuff with Peter Macro? He's over Cheltenham way, isn't he?
Yeah.
How does that link from there to get you to V8 supercars with John Faulkner, or is there a couple of steps in between there?
I used to, when I was doing a bit of go-karts still back when I was working for Peter as well as the motorbikes, and I used to go and see Neil McCauley at lunch breaks because Neil McCauley was my engine builder in go-karts for years and years and still is when I dabble in karts. And he just told me one lunchtime about John Faulkner looking for someone that a mechanic. And it was as simple as I rang John and said, I want a job. And he didn't really care about what I'd done. He just gave me the opportunity. And I'm still thankful for John to this day. And still keep in touch with John, and in 1998 I went there and worked with him. There was only, two of us full-time back then, and we did everything. And I told him a lot of things I could do that I probably couldn't, but I just threw myself in the deep end and just did it. And, within 18 months of being with John, I was, learned how to use MoTeC. I'd learned how to build diffs and gearboxes and fit engines and do setups. And it's just the thing, people don't get the opportunity anymore to go into a small team and learn everything.
And as you said, it was an era where you could have a small team like that.
Yeah.
But with a good car, which was an XHRT Brock car, which by that stage was about 3 or 4 years old when you probably rocked up there.
Yeah.
But you know, he got it in the shootout every year.
What was the name of the car? See how good your memory is.
Beth.
Beth, yeah. Whatever.
What chassis number was it, Baz?
Oh, I don't know.
30. Come on. It? I wrote the book about it, so yeah. It's okay. But it was a time where if you, yeah, sure, HRT, Dick Johnson, Cedo, Stones obviously were starting to really grow then.
Yeah.
But you could actually run a successful business that had successful results that could attract good sponsors like Better Electrical and Fisher and Paykel and achieve good exposure, and it all clicked together before the boom of the next few years that follow.
Yeah, and John was a hard working, had a business around the corner, mechanical business to service and cars, and obviously that was a bit of his cash flow and good sponsors, like you said, with Better Electrical and Fisher and Paykel and Cummins and
stuff.
Did
you get some good deals on some dishwashers or washing machines?
I didn't back then. I didn't really care about that.
You had to get into the Contra early, mate. You have to get in the Contra early.
But, yeah, that was a great place to start. And if it was more like that now, which there still is some of the smaller teams in other categories, but to get into supercars now, you just can't do that. And you bring guys in, you really just got to be a robot. You're doing the same thing every day. You're just trying to make sure the car's as well put together as it can be, but you don't get, everybody doesn't get to do a gearbox or a DFO like we used to. So, and it was a good era to learn the way I learnt, and you had to throw yourself in the deep end and sometimes talk shit to get through. But
wouldn't be the first time in motor racing that's happened.
Exactly, everybody's done that. That's got anywhere. So,
what was the standout memory from your time with JF?
Probably top 10 at Bathurst, and we made the shootout. He had some really good results. You know, some place like Calder, he was always strong. Lauren Park, he was strong. It wasn't so much the results. It's what I learned while I was there, and working with good people like John and some of the team guys that were there. And it was just a little family. Like Thursday night, you'd always go for pizza, and all the volunteers would come in on Thursday night, and we'd all stay back and work till 8:30, 9 o'clock, and go to the local pizza joint in Oakley and talk shit and have some beers. It was really enjoyable situation, and even though it was flat out, it was probably the hardest I've ever worked, but it was just because you're learning so much so quick, you don't even see it as a job. The days go so quick, and it was definitely cemented where I've sort of got to and how much I've learnt in those 2 years.
Now, when the deal with John came up, you had a bit of a diary issue that year, didn't you? So back in those days, Bathurst for the V8s was in November because there was a bit of a split. 2 litre cars were in October.
Yeah.
Before you'd taken that job with John, you had a wedding date, didn't you?
Yeah.
And what did it clash with?
Yeah, it was Bathurst weekend.
So, it's not a good way to start.
Nah, it was a tough one to deal with. But
so what did you do? How did you get around this?
Luckily, firstly, I'm still with my wife, luckily.
Well, it's worked out all right.
I guess I saw the date and I thought, wedding's planned that weekend. Can we change it? There was no way to change it. And I figured I can either not go or...
What, to Bathurst or the wedding?
Either not, not go to Bathurst and get married and do all the stuff that normal people do, but... in typical fashion, I said, nah, I can do this. I can do both. So, luckily, I was valued as someone they needed there. So I got to go up there on the Tuesday, like everyone does, do the whole week leading up. Loretta got to not have me there for the weeks leading up to the wedding, other days, which was probably good for her. And luckily enough, Gary Dumbrell that year, Paul was racing with us that year, so Gary offered to private jet me back up on the... Oh, yeah, actually private jetted me back on the Friday night. I went and played golf in the morning with the boys and come to the wedding, got married, and went to a dodgy hotel at Essendon Airport Saturday night. That was our honeymoon hotel. Jumped on a plane real early. I still remember getting out of the taxi up near the university there and running down the hill towards pit lane because I had about half an hour to check the car, to make sure the boys had put it together properly, and they'd done a really good job. And we started the race, and the tail shaft twisted on the start line, and the day was over. So that was probably the first time I'd been real angry in motorsport because it's like I just fucking wasted all my time.
All that effort for
all time and effort, and the whole team had for a tail shaft to fail and find out that somebody had put exhaust tube instead of chromoly in the tail shaft accidentally. And So when I went up to Queensland the next morning, I wanted to take the tail shaft and throw it through someone's window, but John stopped me doing that. So yeah, my patience back then was probably where it all started. So I'll blame that.
Probably see a theme develop as we talk about a few other things here along the way. But yeah. Good news was, got married. Good news is, still married.
Yep.
So
even
a clashing date with Bathurst, if there's anyone out there listening who gets worried about when their wedding date might be, you can do it, just get a private plane. It'll be fine.
Exactly,
just get someone who you know who can sort you out
and
get you where you
still
need to be.
I think she still resents me a little bit, but she gets over it.
Tell me too, the other thing I remembered when I think of that little John Faulkner era, that when the new cars came, the VT Commodores, remember the cop car?
Yeah, the police car
up at Winton. Yeah. A lot of people have forgotten that, but
I
can't quite remember what the background to it was. I don't think even it was a financial deal. I think it was more an awareness deal of a community program or something like that at the time.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things that happened in Melbourne at some point, one of those shootings or something. And I think John did it as a support for the police, which was really good of him. And it was something passionate he did it for. It wasn't just making a police car. There was a reason. I just can't remember exactly. Yeah.
I've got a weird memory that someone told me from the team that they had like a police-looking uniform and they went to Macca's on the Hume Highway to come back from Winton and got it for free.
Oh, really?
So if you got your uniform from JFR 99, probably wheel it out for a free burger at some stage.
So.
But JFR struggled a little bit after that because the sponsorship got hard, but the whole game stepped up because the sport started going through this really big growth phase. So did it get harder and harder to get a result then? Were other people talking to you about a gig to go somewhere else? What happened in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, I only stayed till towards the end of 99. It was just I'd always been bad at – couldn't stick anywhere for more than 2 years and always wanted to move on and go to bigger and better. And as much as I hated leaving there, I got an opportunity to go to what I thought was going to be a better situation, and it did end up eventually, but I had a little bit in the middle there where a lot of people probably don't know. I went to Gibson Motorsport for a bit to run Steve Richards in the Wins car.
So that's they were Wins in 99 and Kmart in 2000, weren't they?
No, it went from it was when the purchase went through with
when Gary Dumbrell bought the
Gary Dumbrell, right.
So he bought it for 2000 and then the Forbes Ford Lowndes deal for 01.
Yeah, so I ended up, I think Richo didn't get a deal. Richo, I can't remember where he went, Tickford, I think.
He went to Seaton's, yep.
And I ended up, was going to be an engineer on Roddy Forbes' car, and it was then Ford, and I just didn't, I don't know, it wasn't what I'd signed up for, so.
So had you been there for a time thinking?
I'd only been there for 3 weeks.
Right.
3 weeks at Gibson's.
And then the world changed.
Yeah, it was in the off season, so it was sort of like, thanks for the opportunity, but I don't want to be here because it's not what I signed up for. So I actually had Rob Crawford ring me when Kmart Racing started in 2000, and I had a good relationship with Todd Kelly already from the John Faulkner days.
Who'd co-driven the year that the tail shaft.
Yeah, we drove to Bathurst together in 98, actually. On the way there, we went together, and he was only 17-year-old or something. And, so I got the opportunity to go Kmart and took that with both hands and got to spanner the car and engineer the car, because back then that's what you did. Kmart was only Rob Crawford, Eric Pender, probably six of us total. It was a team. And, I was the number one mechanic and race engineer on the car. Eric Pender was MRS engineer and had a couple of mechanics and two apprentices. And, that's how it all started back at Kmart days. And so I was there through that whole journey of Kmart until 2 years ran out again and I got impatient and wanted to move on. And,
Along the way, so that was 01 and 02 from Kmart?
Two
years with Todd?
Yeah, it was actually. Yeah.
So the win at Sandown in the wet, the last round in 01,
yeah,
I remember really well. That was kind of his breakthrough big win.
Yeah, that was
win.
Our last it was 01, wasn't it?
That was 01 and then there was another year in
02. Then we went into 02,
And 02 was the year of the five-minute penalty at Bathurst.
Yeah.
There's a theory floating around from an industry colleague of mine as to why that all happened.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the incident where Greg Murphy pits, goes to leave, the fuel flows everywhere. He leaves the pits, that no fire, but obviously a pretty dangerous situation potentially.
Yeah.
He gets a five. Well, the car gets a 5-minute penalty. He goes to the toilet, comes back to the car in a white rage, and finishes 3 laps down or whatever it was. Now, my industry colleague says, who has a bit of an awareness of the Kmart racing team of that period, that the process was changed of how the management of the pit stops was done at the time. Yep. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how that all came to be?
Yeah, so, I know exactly how it happened and why it happened. And, so I ended up engineering the car that year with Eric Pender as data. We sort of put the two strengths together, or what they call the strengths together, on the one car.
Because in the day, you could pair your two.
Yeah, so we had Murphy and Todd driving together, and we had Rick Kelly and Nathan Pretty, I think, in the second car. Is that right?
I'm trying to remember. That was the year before.
Andy Prio.
That was Prio and Yvonne Muller.
That's it.
Yeah, because it was Yvonne's throne that Murph went to, the toilet.
Yeah. Anyway, we had a pure lead car and a second car. And at some point during the weekend, we decided we were going to drop the car while the fuel was still going in. And so it flows better because the car's lower. And the driver wasn't going to drive off. The car control, which was me at the time, our process was we're not going to stand in the car and waste time when the car was ready to go.
Right in front of it, you're going to stand to the side.
So the car, as soon as it was ready to go, it went. So unfortunately, the car got dropped and the driver drove off.
Clicking back into their normal way of going. There's no one standing in front of me. My car's on the ground. I'm good to go.
Exactly, So it was just a communication thing where, in hindsight, we should have left the car controller standing in front of the car saying stop instead of just being on the radio. And by the time you tag the radio and say stop, the fuel's ripped out of the car. So, it was a shit situation, and we didn't manage it with enough safety factor involved, I guess. And, the history shows that we probably lost that race because the car was really fast that day. And, it proved the next year when they went back there that they, did the 6-8, they won the race and, that year would really set up. I think the car setup was really good, and I think it showed the next 2 years. I think they won, didn't they?
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. I didn't hang around for that, but
2 year itch got you again.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you mentioned before about the number of people that came, and I think everyone thought because it was the HRT sister team at Clayton that it had piles of people and piles of resource, but it wasn't really like that for that place.
No, it was pretty small, and it didn't need to be because the mothership was HRT, so we just had to fit components and tune the cars right.
Mm.
We had a lot less pressure than HRT, so it was probably easier in a way that we weren't expected to beat them. Mm. And when we did, it was good for us, but we should have been just as good because we had the same engines and same components, and it was a great setup for having a strong four-car team.
Mm. And it grew again down the line, and Keys Wheel got involved.
Yeah.
And
that's what I left
chapter. Another chapter.
The whole thing was like when the Gibson's day, I went to Team Brock.
Oh, so, So that was what was for 03?
Yeah, for 03 I wanted to sort of keep my career evolving. I didn't want to stand still.
Because Todd had gone to
HRT.
And Rick had come into Kmart.
Yeah, and I think they brought Teco, Matt Nielsen, over to work with Rick. And I didn't just want to be a mechanic, so I took the opportunity to go to Team Brox to try and keep building on my engineering career. And then they brought Phil Keed in there, and I was like, oh, shit, there's this World Rally sort of engineer going to be the engineer here, and I had to sort of guide him through the thing, and it was like I could see the writing on the wall that I was just going to be a mechanic again for the year, so it's not what I wanted. So, quickly got onto the next thing, and that was Perkins Engineering. And the funny thing here, a lot of people don't know, is that I went in and resigned from the Walkinshaw or whatever you want to call it, Kmart.
Mm.
Had to do it to Jeff Gretsch, and we had a bit of an argument. It wasn't pretty, but... And then on the way to Perkins, I'd done the deal for a job with Larry's manager at the time, and he said to me, I'm not sure whether the role's available and all this. I'm like, what?
I've just quit the job.
So, luckily Paul Dumbrell was part of the reason why I was going to go to Larry's, and I rang Paul and said, can you give me Larry's number? I need to speak to him because his manager's just screwed me over. And I just got the courage to. This was on my way from Kmart to Perkins
on the drive Clayton to Moorabbin.
Yeah, I had to stop and ring Larry and say, "Oh, Larry, I'm this guy that's supposed to be starting with you." He goes, "Oh, I didn't know anything about it, but yeah, what do you do?" And I told him what I did, and he said, "Yeah, you sound like the sort of bloke we need. Yeah, start. You want to start Monday?" I said, "I'll start today if you want."
So, oh, I'm on my way.
So, it was a little bit of a nervous time where I thought I didn't have the job I wanted, and Larry, being Larry, just thought, I've seen him take people on before, and within 6 hours they're out the door. So he'll take someone on that says they can do it, and then it's up to you to prove it.
Soon find out. At this point, what did you want to be? You keep on finding these little roadblocks of what you wanted to do, but ultimately, could you have imagined sitting here as the CEO and the main cheese at a supercar team?
I think that's what I believed. I wanted to do and what I could do. So I just wanted to be. I wanted to run the team. And as arrogant as it sounds, I didn't want to be. Not just a mechanic, but a mechanic for the rest of my life, or a race engineer, or whatever. As much as I love those roles, and there's the same pressures in any of those roles, but I wanted to get to the top. I wanted to be, if I couldn't drive the car, I wanted to run the team. So, and that's what I kept progressing to try and get to a point where, you know, Larry had enough faith in me to let me run Paul Dumbrell that first year in 2003, and then. I got to run the car at Bathurst, the lead car at Bathurst the next couple of years. Then basically I was running the team and engineering the cars and doing dampers and just doing everything, because that's what I was good at and what I liked doing. So, Larry showed a lot of faith in me, but in return I had to do the job. And if I couldn't do the job, there was plenty of times I was dragged out the office and asked what the hell I'd done here or there, but
I was waiting for a Larry impression to come out then.
I always had an answer for him, and luckily he liked my answers and I kept my job for as long as I needed to. So
it does help. Does help. One of the things we didn't cover in the Kmart period that the boys at work do like to look through the old magazines and come up with some things when we know we're coming to speak to some guests for our podcast.
Yeah.
So we talked beforehand about how life and motor racing constantly either clash or have to coexist together.
Yep.
So in the time that you're at Kmart Racing, I think you had a child, did you not?
Yeah, 1999. That was at JF's, and then 2002.
Kmart.
At Kmart, yeah.
Yeah, but was it the Kmart one that you didn't make it to the hospital?
Yeah, yeah. She was born in the car, yeah.
In a Commodore?
Yep. Yeah.
So not only can you engineer race cars, run race teams, you can deliver babies as well.
If you've seen the starting scene of Talladega Nights, it was very similar. I was going down the Frankston Freeway about 5 in the morning and doing about 100 mile an hour, like he says in that.
And we're actually – so, all right, it's all happening. We've got to get there. Yep. We've got to get there where it's
I'm like, you'll be right. Just hang on. And she's like, no, I'm pushing and pushing. And I've turned around and, seen this half a baby's head poking out and – had to slam on the brakes, and within the time of stopping the car and getting around the back, the baby was born, and I'm sitting on the side of the freeway in Frankston with a baby in my hands, and had to ring the hospital. Luckily, it was only 5 minutes away, and she's a healthy baby girl, and it was an experience, I can assure you. But it's one I'll never forget, and it's good. Yeah.
It's one way to make an arrival onto the planet, that's for sure. That's definitely one way to go. So tell me about Larry. A lot of people got a lot of Larry stories and a lot of an impression of LP, but I get the feeling from watching the way you run your team, there's a lot of Larry in the way you go about how you run Erebus. Fair call?
Yeah. The best way I explain Larry is it's just no bullshit. It's just what you see is what you get with him. And all you have to be with Larry is honest. If you're honest and you know how to do your job, it's fine. And if you don't know how to do your job, he'll try and help you learn how to do your job better. It might not always be the nicest way he does it, but
I think he's mellowed in his older age, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he has. But he's the best person to work for. From what I've done with him, and there was times where I just didn't want to deal with him. Didn't think it was the right environment, but that was the immature side. But when you realise the way he treats his people, they're all treated really well. And you had people that had been there their whole careers, and you don't have people like that unless they're doing something right. And Larry was just – he's just really good to work for, and he teaches you. But if you were soft, like a lot of the generation now, you wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes with him, because it wasn't an easy place to work, but it was as hard as you made it. If you were a good employee and you did your job, and he'd give everyone a pat on the back if they did a good job, and he'd also give you a kick in the ass if you weren't doing a good job. But that's how it should be.
I remember that period, sort of 04 to 06, so the Castrol into Jack Daniels era. Steve Richards was a regular contender for the championship. He was at the front. What was the bit that was missing to get, you know, at the time Stones were kind of the dominant guys.
Yeah.
HRT was still HRT and running at the front. But what was a little bit that you would have needed there just to push into a, you know, a proper championship tilt to,
oh, no, it was
to
difficult.
Get a few more wins on the board?
It's hard to say, because we had so much right there. And you know, I was obviously engineering Richo through that period, and it was great fun going to each race and knowing that you had a chance of winning. And if I knew what it was that we needed to win, we probably would have fixed it. But you know, if you really boil it down, and it was probably our cars were built more on the finished Bathurst. Everything was strong and heavy, and you know, technically, if you could have lightened some components and done what some of the, you know, wanky engineers do, which
I knew
which
you were going to say
wasn't,
that word.
Wasn't, but it's not wanky. That's what you need to do to get that last little bit of performance, and that's just not what Perkins Engineering was. It was based around, let's go to Bathurst and win. All these other races are fill-in races.
Warm-ups. Yeah.
But we still were really competitive, and we had some great aspects of the car that work really well. But if you wanted to be nitpicky, you'd go back and lighten some bits a little bit and make them, you know, so they're a little bit more risk of braking, but and it might have got that last couple hundredths of a second. But yeah, there's certainly nothing wrong. It was just the way we, Perkins Engineering went about racing was more around enduro racing than just a sprint race win.
What about the Kangaroo? Remember that one?
Oh,
Jim Richards in the Steve Richards car at Bathurst?
Yeah, that was pretty disappointing. Yeah, we were really strong that year, and it was Jim and Steve driving together, so it was an awesome thing to be involved with, and to hit that Kangaroo was devastating, and yeah, something you still look back on and go, what could have been? But yeah.
There's a million ways to get eliminated from a Bathurst 1000. Yeah. You've probably seen most of them now.
Yeah,
but
I've seen most of them. Drivers can even fatigue, funny enough.
I haven't even got that far down the timeline yet. We're still in the mid-2000s, mate. But
don't bring up the wall.
Well, the next year, I think, was the year that Dunbrough had the wheel come off that hit Lowndes in the windscreen.
Yep.
I think the next year in the Jack Daniels car, Richard, remember that he had that huge tyre blowout on the Thursday practice, or it was on Conrod.
Yeah.
It's probably the biggest supercar crash never caught on external cameras.
Yeah, it was huge.
And you both rebuilt it, a huge overnight job.
Yeah, he was just on the radio coming down Conrod talking about how good the car was and, you know, what we needed to do. And then all of a sudden you could hear the fear in his voice.
Like he's halfway through talking.
Yeah. And it was like, what the hell just happened there? And I think it came up on the TV and we're like, Richo, you're right? And he's like, yeah, I'm right, but I've had the world's biggest crash. And I'm like, what the fuck happened there? Sorry, I shouldn't swear. But
we can bleep. Yeah. Actually, you know what? We bleeped swear words in the first few episodes of our podcast, and we got told off by our listeners who said, don't bleep it. Yeah. So we don't bleep it, unless it's really, really bad. But that's not really, really bad. And I think there was I have a vivid memory of Dumbrell. It must have been late in the race, exiting the pits as the safety car peeled out. And he keyed through and said, the safety car's just hit me, which normally people talk about, I'm going to hit the safety car at Days of Thunderstar. And I don't think it actually hit him, but it did everything. But
yeah, it was close. We just got out of pit lane
at the very
time,
same time. Yeah. So the Perkins era, kind of Richards and Dunbrell moved on at the end of 06. I talked to Jack Perkins about this very recently, who you've got a long relationship with from back in those days. Yep. And, of course, he's driving with Will Brown at Bathurst later on in the year. Shane Price was going to step it up from the development series.
Yeah.
There were chats with John Bow about coming and finishing his career in one of the JD cars.
Yeah.
But at the end, he decided to stick in a Ford because he kind of had a Ford thing going, and Jack got what was a bit of an upgrade that he probably, in hindsight, says he wasn't ready for.
Yeah, yeah.
So the decision to go with the young guys at the time, you could see the merit in it, but it didn't really work.
No, it was. I don't know. It was pretty tough back then. The field was really, really strong, and it is now too, I know. But, you know, if you compare it to what we've done with Will and Brody, Jack and Shane probably weren't anywhere near as prepared as Will and Brody are now to enter the elite level. But, you know, when you took them to tracks they knew, like Winton, I think they both qualified in the top 10.
Yeah.
So the potential was there. It was just going to each track and learning the tracks, which – sometimes they both had to do, was just too hard, and then you fall behind a bit with development because you're trying to, you know, teach the drivers how to drive more than trying to make the cars fast. And yeah, it was a tough year, but I think it was a year you probably needed to just prove that sometimes drivers are the part you do need to make the car fast. And Jack and Shane, you know, to their credit, there was a massive amount of pressure, and they did as good a job as you could expect, I think, in that year. And Winton was definitely the highlight, having them both in the top 10 and proving that they could drive the car. It's just the rest of it, you know, go to each track and being able to put it on the limited, a track they don't know as well, was hard.
Todd Kelly turned up the next year, so he followed you. He got back to you eventually. And then Larry's team closes down, and then it became Kelly. So did that change anything for you, or did you just roll along with it, or how did that all unfold?
I rolled along with it. Yeah, we was at 2009 Kelly's start, I think. Yeah, so Todd was there 2008. And I think Todd's very ambitious. He's proven that over the years. And I think leaving HRT was probably he wanted to take the next step in his level of driving, and, you know, being part of a team and part of building a team back up. And, you know, Todd was a good influence there and brought some good things that he'd learnt from HRT, obviously. And yeah, we worked together again, and that was it was good, but it was difficult again. And
why difficult?
I don't know.
Were you getting the itches here, or just what was the scenario?
No, not really. I think I'd found my place. I wanted to, if I had a choice, I'd still work for Larry now if he was still going. But just what we went through there and what I learnt through that whole journey was what I wanted to do with racing. So I'd got a comfort level there. So I'd been at Larry's for 5 years then, and then it moved down to Todd's, and it was different. You know, Todd had a different idea of how he wanted to do things, and it was fine, but yeah. We carried a lot of things from Perkins that were really good, and some of the things we didn't carry over. And
what did you carry? What didn't you carry? Because a lot of the people,
the way we manufactured things, we carried over the way the engine department ran, and all that was really strong. And it was just different. It's hard to explain. But, you didn't have Larry, you know, the father figure there, sort of you could go up to and spew your guts to, and you know, tell him about ideas, and he'd give you the little bit you had missing in your idea, which was the really real good strength of Larry, that you could do that. You knew you had the idea, you knew it was really close to something you could implement, but you just needed him to get that last bit of thought out of your head. And I think that's what we missed once Larry was not there anymore. Even I could still drive down the road and talk to him about stuff, but he didn't have the passion was gone for it because it wasn't his business. So, you know, it was a different situation. But, no, it was – the Kelly era was good. But 2009, who did I work with? I can't even remember. But there, I was doing dampers. I was running the team at one stage, running head of engineering. It was just – it got a bit too much. And in 2011, I worked with Murph, I love working with Murph. It was just – a really good, enjoyable year, but it was tough for the team. We didn't get a lot of results, and there was a bit of angst in the team, and it just got to a point where I just didn't want to be there anymore. And a couple of things went down that it's not worth bringing up, but I resigned at Bathurst that year. And
which was the best race of the year for you guys, because we've got pole and finished on the podium with Alan Simonson.
Yeah, got pole. It doesn't matter how we got pole. It rained halfway through the shootout.
But doesn't matter. It is in the stats books as exactly, a pole. Yeah. Doesn't matter how.
And we got a podium, so we must have had a decent car. And, yeah, I actually resigned on the Friday night there and saw the year out.
Oh, at the race meeting?
At the race meeting, yeah.
Because it hit fever pitch at the race meeting or yeah, because you had, just decided
that's yeah, it? Yeah, there's a few internal issues right. that I just didn't agree with. So, I decided I wanted to leave and I saw the year out. And by the time we got to Christmas, I'd sort of half agreed that I'll probably come back.
Mm.
But I said I need Christmas to think about it and decided that, no, it's not where I wanted to be. So I actually had a bit of a gap year, 2012, went and worked with Bruin Beasley and won a Formula Ford Championship with Jack LeBrock and had a bit of fun along the way and obviously started the Erebus journey in 2012 as well.
And that's what I really wanted to delve into. How does – so at the time, Erebus is not in supercars. Betty's been doing GTs with Mercedes and had an involvement with Pete Hackett and F3 and stuff like that before that. But how did you two get together to begin with? Because this is – we're going back pretty much nearly 10 years now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I got a call out from Rick Kemp. I think it was Rick Kemp at the time.
Who was the Coney Shop guy?
Yeah, Coney Shop guy.
And did a lot of engineering and stuff.
I got on really well with Rick. And
worst teller of jokes, I reckon I've ever. I've heard drivers who have been put to sleep during safety car periods at the 12-hour Bathurst.
Yeah.
By Rick telling jokes.
Yeah.
Who was trying to actually make them stay awake but put them to sleep.
Yeah, I'd had a good relationship with Rick just through the Coney thing and just being a couple of race engineers that were trying to do our thing. And they needed someone at Erebus as a part-timer, so I ended up going to the 12-hour. So I'd only been out of supercars, and I went back to the 12-hour with Erebus just as a contractor. Mm. And
to help run it, engineer it?
Help manage the team for the weekend and race engineer one of the cars. I was only one there, because it was a Black Falcon car. But yeah, so basically to guide the team through a Bathurst 12-hour, and I'd never done one, but I'd obviously
was
done some
was
Bathurst.
Wet? Was that that wet year? It's not the winning year, was
no,
it?
No. Yeah. 2013 was
the
wet,
winning year.
Yeah, so 2012, we at the end of it, we come second. Tim Slade.
Euro Bleekemolen.
Peter Hackett.
And Brett Curtis, the American.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
It's all in our Bathurst Going Global 12-hour book that you got a copy of here in front of you. Photo of every car from every year. You can buy it from our online store now. Barry Ryan does recommend it. He hasn't opened it yet, but he recommends
looks great.
It.
So. Yeah, so that's where the Erebus journey started. I met Betty and Daniel there. And funny story out of that was Daniel. I hadn't formally met Daniel, Betty's husband. And we got together as a group, and I said, "Oh, mate, what do you do?" And he said, "Oh, what do you want me to do?" I said, "Oh, we need a fire person for the race. Yeah, someone to hold the fire extinguisher." And he goes, "Yeah, I'll do that." I said, "Okay." Just moved on to the next thing.
Had no idea who he was.
Had no idea. And then Ryan Madison came up to me, who was the CEO at the time, and said, "Are you new who that was?" And I said, "No." He's going to be the fire guy. He said he wanted to do something. And it was, I weren't learned it was Betty's husband. And he embraced it. He put the fire suit on. And he stood there all day with a fire extinguisher and loved it. But, he'd probably still do it now if we asked him. So, that was the way I act in a race team. When you got a group of people and somebody puts their hand up and says, "I want to do something," well, there you go.
Off you go. There's a job.
Yeah, there's a job.
Did you get along with Betty and Daniel straight away? Because you're very different types of people, different backgrounds, different personalities, but it seems to have
I didn't know who they were. Like, honestly, no idea at all.
No, I
think I had to Google to find out who Betty was. But I didn't care. She's someone that owned a race team and wanted someone to work for her, and I just went and worked for her for a weekend. So I think it was only after the race meeting where all these people have been telling me, "Oh, she's got a lot of money, she does." I'm like, "I don't care. I just want to go racing." Mm. So, I think I Googled her and sort of went, "Oh, shit, she's done a bit of stuff and she's got a huge business." And, her father was, owned Westfield and all this. So, whatever, that's fine. Doesn't change what
Let's
I
go
do.
Car racing. Yeah.
Yep.
And then, so the Erebus GT program. The supercar thing started in 13 up in the old Stone Brothers workshop up in Queensland, but the Erebus GT program was separate, and it was here in Melbourne, wasn't it?
Yep.
It was a separate thing completely.
Yeah.
So you, at that point, did you start to become sort of running the ship there, contracting, and it just sort of seemed like it just evolved.
Yeah, 2012, I was just going to the race meetings. So I was committed to Bruin for his Formula Ford program, so I stuck by that. And then Bruin also did a Super 2 car that year with Elliot Palmer. Mm-hmm. So I helped Bruin get involved with Super 2 and made sure he, you know, as a good mate of mine, I made sure he sort of skipped all the hurdles that you can get involved in with the supercar. So, yeah, it was actually good working with a mate for a year and combining a bit of the Erebus part-time stuff. And I did a bit of stuff with the Super Tourer thing in New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, just, that's right, yeah. Yep.
Just that M3 with Murph's team,
yep.
Or 3M or whatever they're called. Yeah, it was just a year where I got to do a heap of different things and it probably taught me that I really wanted to be back in full professional motorsport, but it was still a good learning year. Heaps of stuff I learned. I didn't know anything about Formula Fords before that year, and we went and won a championship because Bruin obviously taught me a lot, and then I brought a little bit of the stuff in that I thought I could help with, and we had a really successful year, and it was great fun and built on the relationship with Erebus and Betty and Ryan Madison, and sort of tried to put whatever I could, all my effort into how we could make that program massive and without spending stupid money. And it was fairly successful, some of the races that year with GT. And then 2013 came along. What did we do there? We had Jack LeBrock.
In the GT car. The 12-hour that year with Bernd Schneider.
Yeah. That was a good fun year. It was I'm trying to think back, but yeah, we won the 12-hour, which was a great thing to do, and we could have almost come 1-2 if the Aussie car, we'll call it, the purple car, didn't have an incident.
Was that the Slade Holdsworth Hackett car?
Yeah.
Had an issue late.
Hit a back marker.
That's right.
On a restart, hit a back marker and damaged the car.
That's right.
Lost a couple of laps. But
where does that 12-hour win stand out in your racing career? That right up there?
Yeah, it was really good, yeah, to go back there after coming second the year before and head up a two-car thing, I guess. And at one point we were, I think, 1-2 going down a straight, half a lap ahead, and we're like, oh, this is a bit easy. And
Bathurst does.
But it was good because back then you had to have an AM driver, and obviously Alex Roloff was technically an AM driver, but really, really experienced, particularly at Nürburgring. So he came to Bathurst and there was no fear at all. He's like, this is easy.
This is just another track. So,
yeah, he was a real gentleman, and he did an awesome job when he was up against AMs and pros, and brought the car home in the wet without any mistakes. And, yeah, it was to work with guys like Bernd Schneider and Thomas Jaeger and Alex was brilliant.
And that car is up at the museum, at the National Motor Racing Museum at Bathurst. So what's the – we have a tie-in with the museum. We work with them really closely on a bunch of stuff. So what's the go with that car? Was it the 12-hour winner and you just parked it straight after that, or did it do a bit before and after? Or?
No, it did. I think the next season we only ran one car.
So Richard Musket in GT?
No, Max Twigg and Jeff Emery drove the other car. That car went back into service just as normal. And then, when it was a point where we weren't racing GT anymore, we just put it back to Bathurst winning spec, and that's its history now. You can still go and probably charge the battery, put some fuel in it, and take it for a drive.
Well, we'll take you up on that one day.
Yeah.
Now that you've floated it out there, it's so simple. Just fire it up
and
let it ride. But the cool cars, the gull wings, the engine note of that.
Good
that
fun to work AMG on. Engine. Some of the stuff we did back then when we went to Macau. Macau was 2013 as well, I think. And we should have, it's always should have, could have, would have, but we should have won that race. We got a puncher with three laps to go. And Mauro was, I think, 10 seconds up the road. And that was a huge disappointment, not just for us, but for AMG, because they were. The one race they were desperate to take off the Audis, because the Audis had dominated there with Mr. Macau, what was his name? Eduardo Montoro.
That's the one.
Montoro.
Yeah, you can pronounce it better than me.
Yeah. So, it was disappointing to lose that year. And then, we went back the next year. that for the next year? I can't remember. Yeah.
Something.
Anyway, yeah, it was typical Macau.
Yeah, it's one of those places and one of those events. It's a weird stuff happens. It's a bit Bathurst-like in that regard. Mm. So the whole time here in your Erebus life, you've got nothing to do with the supercar project?
No, not until early 15, really, yeah.
So was that a case of we need some more hands on deck, or how did that all evolve?
I don't know. I don't want to get too political with it, but I was supposed to
be. More than welcome to get a little bit political if you like. Yeah. You can do what you want.
I went to a lot of the initial meetings in Germany and, you know, about how the supercar program was going to happen. So I was sort of part of it. But then when they bought into Stones, it was like they didn't really need me because they had the expert of Ross Stone and Jimmy left. So it wasn't Jimmy and, you know, David Stewart and all the people up there, they had the experts. So I don't think there wasn't a feeling that they needed an extra person. So I sort of just watched it happen in the background for a bit there. But then, as I can't not say things when I'm if it's something I see that I don't think's right, I'll stand up and say it. And you know, it took a while to get my point across that I think we could be doing this different. And that's not against anybody there that did anything. They had a massive task and they did the task. They got the cars on track. And it's easy in hindsight for anyone to look at stuff and say, you could have done it better. But that's not what I'm saying. But when I got to a point where I was asked to formally go in and review what was going on there in 2015, I was just completely honest with what I thought. And it was a real, not a road to nowhere, but there was so much money that needed to be spent to go another level with the car and the engines and even medium term with the engines to try and get cylinder heads and blocks and stuff off AMG. There was no factory support. So whatever you had to buy off AMG, you had to pay for.
You were just another customer paying an invoice.
It was just huge, huge dollars. So there was no real need to do it. Like there was no support from... There was no extra support from sponsors because you're in an AMG. There was no commercial reason to do it. So,
and when you went to all those first meetings, was there any other options that could have unfolded instead of buying Stones? Or was that kind of
I think that was pretty much the only option at the time to get an existing team and get a car on the track in a short period of time. There was other ways, and I spelled out other ways I thought we could do it, but some of them were just real pie-in-the-sky shit, which we would have made happen, but it would have been a lot tougher than... Well, they did it tough, but, yeah, it could have been nearly impossible some of the other ways to do it. To do what they did was incredible to do it, but, there are other ways it could have been done. Yeah, and that could have been... That's also... Supercars could have helped out with... You know, what we're going to now with this next generation, the way the engines are going and that could have suited the original concept, which was the SLS engine as it was.
From the GT car.
6.2 engine, yeah. But that was initially ticked off. Yep, that can happen. And then shut down Germany.
Which made the whole thing make sense.
Yeah.
But then suddenly if it changes, it doesn't make as much sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was part one of our chat with Barry Ryan from Erebus Motorsport. Next week on part two, we chat more about his time at Erebus, about Betty Klemenko, about winning the Bathurst 12 Hour, the Bathurst 1000, the very infamous documentary series that so many people saw Barry in, and we also talk about what's going on with Erebus Garage. Barry tackles your National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions and also tackles our V8 Sleuth Top 10 Shootout. Don't forget to jump into our bookshop online. The website address is bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Pick yourself up a bargain. There is plenty of good stuff to be added to your bookshelf or to your DVD shelf. Sign up for our newsletter via the v8sleuth.com.au website and follow us on socials, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. We are there and busy and always active, so make sure you get in touch with us. Give us your feedback. Give us your ideas for future podcast guests and the like. Look forward to hearing from you. Don't forget to, every Tuesday, Repco Supercars Weekly, our look at the Repco Supercars Championship. It's an additional to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Make sure you join us for the next step of Repco Supercars Weekly on Tuesday. We'll have part two of Barry Ryan next week. In the meantime, enjoy your week. We're signing off from the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco.